I'm so glad you're here this morning. If you have your Bibles, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Genesis, chapter 1. Today is week 4 of our In the Beginning series, and hard to believe, but we're already winding the series down. We've been looking at Genesis 1 over the past 4 weeks, and as a way to conclude my 5 weeks of this series, Awaken Dojo number 3 will be next Sunday. Now, some of you are wondering, what is a dojo? Because I know just saying, well, it's a dojo doesn't clear things up. So the dojo, Ruby, who's not here today, has been doing a fabulous job promoting the dojo. Better job than me, because I talk about it and like one person signs up, she talks about it, and like the list just grows. So I'm going to try to channel my inner Ruby if I can do that. And next Sunday, following our service 1 to 3 at Hillside Church in Armonk, dojo number 3 will be an opportunity for us to get together, gather together as a group, and we are going to talk about all the things that we've been talking about here in this Genesis 1 series over the past 4 weeks, including next week, week 5. So if you're going to go to the dojo, bring your questions, because the thing that I realized it even more this week as I was putting this series together, or this sermon together, we just scratched the surface on what Genesis 1 is all about. Some people are like, whoa, how can you speak 5 weeks on Genesis 1? Like, how can't you? How can you contain it in 5 weeks? So if you have other questions, because I'm sure this series has raised other questions about Genesis 1 and what it means for us today, please bring those questions with you. We will have an opportunity to talk through some of those questions. And then because it's a dojo, there will be some spiritual practices, just like you would practice kickboxing and punching in a karate dojo. We'll be doing some spiritual kickboxing, if can say that. A couple of practices, and then there will be discussion as well. Always a great time, as we've heard from Ruby. Everyone always walks away feeling inspired and encouraged, and that's my goal for dojo number 3. Now, if you do need childcare, please note it on that form in the back. If you're going to carpool, note that as well, so we can make sure that we have all of that taken care of for you. And today, but of course, you know how I work. I'll extend the RSVP for like maybe 2 more days. So we do need to know, though, in order to plan accordingly. So if you are going to go to the dojo, sign up on the back table, send me an email, and we'll make sure that we're all set for that one. Now, Joe has said that he wants to extend the series a little longer, so I said I'll be doing 5 weeks, but Joe is actually going to take it to a 6th week, so that's coming up in 2 weeks. And then after that, I mentioned last week, over the summer, I want to address the questions that you have about God and faith and spirituality and the Bible. And I've been getting some great questions so far. Please keep the questions coming. And I'm going to try a little different format that I'm going to keep as a surprise until the 23rd when we start this series. But if you have more questions, there's some white slips of white paper on the back table. Please write your question down and place it in the black box. You can also do it through our newsletter as well. And I'm going to begin to compile all those and start to figure out what you want to talk about this summer. How's that sound? All right, I got 2 thumbs up on this side, so I'm liking you guys. I did. Just got to be a little louder next time, please. All right, I like this side too. I'm doing all right this morning. So what I want to do this morning is I want to talk about this phrase, image of God. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? And as I said earlier, this could be a whole 5-week series in itself. So I'm just kind of condensing over the next 30 minutes. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? And we're going to go all sorts of places this morning. So first, let's read Genesis 1, starting in verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind, and as we said last week, this is mankind and womankind, in his own image, in the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Now, in order to understand this phrase, image of God, I have to show you two ways in which this phrase would have been understood in the ancient world. So we have to talk about idols and kings. First, let's talk about idols. In the ancient world, we're talking 2,000-3,000 years ago, so a long, long time ago, there was a certain pattern to creation stories, like this ancient story that we read here in Genesis 1. The pattern goes like this. There is a God who subdues the primordial chaos. Then the victorious God has a temple built in his name. After the temple is built, the God rests. So we've been talking about this Marduk creation story over the past couple of weeks. Marduk defeats the great sea goddess Tiamat, the chaos monster. After Marduk defeats Tiamat, a temple is built for him, and then he rests on his divine bed in his temple, in his home. There's another god maybe you're familiar with by the name Baal in the Old Testament. We come across Baal quite often in the Old Testament. Same idea. Baal defeats the ancient chaos monster. Baal has a temple built for himself, and then Baal rests. In Genesis 1, we find God following the same pattern. God defeats the tohu vavohu, this primordial chaos. God subdues it by his word, creates boundaries and form and shape. And then God begins to build his temple. But rather than a temple that's constructed of wood or steel or brick or mud or mortar, what they used to build homes and temples with back in the day, God builds a temple which is the entire cosmos. Isaiah 66, written around the same time as Genesis 1, picks this idea up. This is what the Lord says: heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me? Where will my resting place be? Has not my hand made all these things? Has not my hand already made my house? Have I not already created? And so they came into being, declares the Lord. What we find here is that what Genesis 1 is showing is that God is building a temple. The temple that's being built is all creation. In other words, there's not a house that can contain God. There's not a church that can contain God. There's no building that can contain God's presence, because God's presence is everywhere. There's nowhere, as one of the psalmists says, there's nowhere you can run from the presence of God. There's nowhere you can hide. Everywhere you walk, God is present. This is how the Bible begins, with God creating a home for himself, God creating a temple. Everywhere you go, you are in the Lord's house. You don't go to the Lord's house on a Sunday morning. You're always in the Lord's house. Now, after this temple is built, what's the final thing that God does? He takes a nap. He's tired. He just expended a whole bunch of energy. God rests. The end of this creation story actually trickles a little bit into chapter 2. It says, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. Thus God's temple was completed. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing. And so on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. He kicked back on the back porch. He sat in the recliner. Cold glass of iced tea. Nice book. Maybe the baseball game and the radio on the background. God's like, I just did all time for me to kick my legs up now for a while. Then God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, before the God, whoever's temple is being built, rests, there's one final piece that has to be placed into the temple. And let me tell you, in the words of J. Richard Middleton, the final piece is the installation of the cult image of the deity to whom the temple was dedicated. In other words, the final piece that goes into a temple is a statue or is an idol depicting whose house you've just walked into. So the final piece, it's like an artist. Whenever an artist finishes a piece of work, whenever Da Vinci finished a piece of art, he would sign his name on it to let everyone know, this is the artist who created this work. So once a temple was built for a god, whichever god it might be in the ancient world, the final piece was this idol, this statue, so that everyone would know, this is the god whose house you've just walked into. So here's a picture of the great Marduk. Oh, sorry, this is Baal. This is a little Baal statue. Scary little fella, is he not? How many of you would like to have a Baal statue in your bedroom? What kind of nightmares are going to be created from that one? There's a Baal statue, and I think I have a picture of Marduk as well. There's the great Marduk. Bit scary as well, is it not? So we have a couple. Some of you are like, oh, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I could have one over my bed. So you have these statues that are built, that are placed, and the statues were really important in the ancient world. That's why if you have an army that comes in to defeat your people, the army will raid the temple, and they'll either break the statue or they'll steal the statue as a way to leave you powerless, because the idol signified that the god that you served, the god that your people served, was alive and active and was powerful. So if someone came in and stole your idol, well, now you were vulnerable because now your god was no longer there to protect you. Where in Genesis 1 do we find the idol being built and placed? Go to the next slide. Let us make mankind in our image. Thank you. You would have these temples that were built, and then an idol would be put here, infused with the god's power. Whenever the god of Babylon would come to power, when he was going to become king, he would walk into the temple of Marduk, place his hands on the golden Marduk statue, because all of Marduk's power would then be transferred to the Babylonian king. Here in Genesis 1, this subversive, revolutionary text is now saying, this god doesn't need a golden statue. This god doesn't need a wooden idol, because this god has you. You are the image of the god that has created everything that you can see. You are the image of the divine. Now let's talk about kings for a moment. In the ancient world, it was believed that the kings were the representative of the god that their people worshiped and their people followed. I got two lines from two letters written around the 7th century BCE about Assyrian kings. It says, the king of the world is the very image of Marduk. The king, my lord, is the image of Marduk. The word of the king, my lord, is just as final as that of the gods. In other words, whatever the king says is what Marduk says. Whatever the king's word is the god Marduk's word. In the ancient world, the king was a conduit of the god's power. All of a sudden, in Genesis 1, what we now find is that humans, every single one of us, not just one individual, not one group of people, special people, but rather every single one of us are to be a conduit of God's power. We've all been infused with divine power, potential, and purpose. And through how we live our lives is how we show, how we reveal the God whose power, potential, purpose we've been given. Do you see how revolutionary this idea would have been at the time? Now, let's talk a little bit about why this mattered in the ancient world and why this matters for us. I mean, this is a giant step forward in understanding what it means to be human. Because up until this point in time, it was only one person or maybe a small group of people who were created in the divine image, but now it's all of us. If we can think back to week one, which I know is a long time ago, and you can't even remember what you had for dinner last night, I said that Genesis 1 was written while the Israelites were exiled in Babylon. Now, when you have a group of people that are taken from their home, removed from their home, and forced to live in a foreign land, they have to listen to all these advertisements of the people whose land they're living in. So they're forced to hear about the Babylonian way of life. They're forced to hear Babylonian philosophy. And what did Babylonian philosophy have to say about humans? Well, it said that humans, minus maybe the king, were simply insignificant servants of the gods. Remember, in Babylon, Marduk created humans out of the blood of the defeated gods. So you, humanity, was created out of the blood of the defeated beings. You, in other words, were insignificant. You were created to be a servant, to do the things that the gods didn't want to do because the gods were tired. They didn't want to do all the chores. Enter humanity. In Babylon, it was believed that humans were simply victims who were at the mercy of the gods. There were these forces at play in the world, somewhere in the unseen world, and you were simply victims of their power struggle. You were also, if you were in Babylon, it was believed that humanity were simply powerless slaves. You had no power. You had no dignity. You had no worth, no value. Again, maybe the king had some value, but surely not us common folk. I mean, that's something that's reserved for the king, not for us. So if you're an Israelite and you've just been removed from your homeland, from your God, from everything you've ever known, now all of a sudden you're exposed to Babylonian culture and you've just gone through your whole world crashing down in front of you, are you not going to be tempted to believe this way of thinking? When everything was ripped from you, will you not be tempted to think, wow, look at everything we've been through. Surely we're nothing but victims. Look at our situation, far removed from everything we have ever placed our hope in, anything we have ever trusted in, and it was forcefully removed from us. Of course, we're insignificant humans. Life is chaotic, meaningless. Life is purposeless. There's nothing that we can place our hope in, nothing we can place our trust in besides the fact that life will let you down. I'm sure the exile threatened to take all the humanity, all the dignity that the Israelites had and take it from them and leave them in this confused, powerless place. I mean, who hasn't had these thoughts before? Who hasn't asked these questions? Who of us here hasn't experienced a dark moment of confusion? Who hasn't wondered if life is meaningless, if there's no purpose to who we are and what we're doing? Who hasn't wondered if life is simply this big, chaotic mess and that we're simply victims of life? Who hasn't thought that life is just something that happens to us and we're powerless to stop it or rise above it or do anything about our situation? I remember after Reese was born, you all saw it, what the most difficult time in my life. Steph had herniated a disc. Reese wasn't sleeping at night, waking up maybe every 2 to 3 hours, which meant we weren't sleeping. I started experiencing these health problems. I could barely do my work. I had to take time off from work because I just couldn't do it anymore. And as I was in this period of time, it was as if my identity began to be shaped by the fact that, well, this is unfair. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve what I'm going through. Why do they have it easier than we do? Why do I have, am I being punished for something? Am I simply just a victim of what's happening? Is this how life is going to be from here on out? And the longer that I began to identify with this way of thinking, the more disempowered I became, the more depressed and anxious and joyless and bitter and apathetic, the more disinterested I became in anything. It felt, my life felt restless and chaotic. It was like I was just descending back into that primordial tohu vavohu that existed before the creation. Have you ever experienced a moment like this where life just feels like it doesn't make sense? Yeah, it's called being human. We've all been there. And oftentimes we try to avoid it, or we try to pretend like it's not real, but the truth is that only makes it worse. See, like the Israelites living in exile, we live in a world that often disempowers us. We live in a world that dehumanizes us. We live in a world that threatens to take away joy and the very life that is pulsing through our veins. And then we all go through these moments of pain and exile and loss and hardship. And we begin to wonder, are we insignificant creatures? Or are we insignificant people who are powerless? Or are we simply insignificant creatures who have to let life happen to us? And whatever happens, we're just going to be battered by the storms back and forth. We begin to wonder, is life simply chaos and meaninglessness? Is there any purpose to what I'm doing here, to my existence? And so Genesis 1 comes with a bold statement and says, never for a moment, never for even 1 second are you to believe that you are powerless. Never for a moment are you to believe that you are insignificant, that you've been cast aside, that the gods, that the universe, the forces of this world are against you, but rather you are to believe that you have been birthed with divine power and divine purpose and divine potential. A phrase, image of God, that was reserved for royalty and idols infused with power is now being used to describe you. You have divine power. You have divine purpose. You have divine potential. You have divine, God-given responsibility to care for this world, this temple that you have been placed in. And oftentimes, what happens is we go through a situation and we're threatened to become bitter. And our whole life becomes about getting even or getting payback for what it is that's been done to us. But this Genesis 1 story comes with a new message and says, I challenge you to live out of your power, to live out of your God-given potential, to set aside what has happened, because we all know that there are things in life that do not go our way. And we're threatened to just give up. We're threatened to just sit on the couch, to fold our hands, to just stay there and say, well, there's nothing that I can do about this. But Genesis 1 comes with a new message and says, that's not your true identity. Your true identity is as someone who has been given the very power of God to unleash upon this world. I mean, do you see how empowering this message would have been for a dejected group of exiles living far from their home? Do you see how powerful this message is for us in our lives today? See, whenever I begin a sermon, I often start with a question, what is it that I need to hear? What do I need to hear? So I'm really just preaching to myself. And the truth is, I need to hear this message. I need to hear the radical message that's being conveyed here in Genesis 1 because I forget. And because I go through hard times. And I'm threatened to define myself as a victim, as someone who is just at the mercy of these forces. Or I'm threatened to believe that I'm insignificant, that I have nothing to offer, that doing something in the world, well, that's great for them, but who am I that I could even do anything at all? How could I ever help anyone? How could I ever reveal God to this world? I'm threatened all the time in my identity to just look at myself as an insignificant creature with nothing to offer. And so I need to hear this message all the time to remind myself that that's not what's truest about me. See, what happens is when you live into this way of thinking that you're simply a victim, it prevents you from risking. It prevents you from stepping out. It prevents you from loving. Because you're just trying, you keep trying to protect yourself and you don't want to be hurt like you had been hurt before. And so you stop risking and you stop caring about anything and you just stay on the couch thinking, here, maybe at least I'll be safe for a time. It keeps you from showing the world the gift of your life. Your life is a gift. We, this entire world, needs you to be engaged. This entire world needs you to be that conduit of God's love and grace. And when we see ourselves simply as victims, we become apathetic to the whole thing and think, well, what's the point? Why even bother? Why should I even lift my finger? Why should I go and help? Because there's no meaning, there's no purpose to what it is that I'm going to be doing. And so Genesis 1 comes in and gives us this radical, empowering message and says, I know you're tempted to see yourself as insignificant, as a victim. But don't for a moment believe that's your truest identity. Rather, your identity is as royalty. Your identity is as someone who has been infused with divine power and purpose and potential. Your life is a gift. And we all need you to use the gift of your life in a way that moves this entire creation forward into greater love, into justice, into fairness for all people. And if you were to just sit this one out on the couch for a while, we would miss out on the life that you can bring. Let me pray here this morning.